Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the show. Hi. Tonight, first off, welcome everyone. Tonight we're going to do what in radio they call a break in format. And what that means in English is that those of you who have listened semi-regularly or regularly know, we normally open the show with a reading of headlines and I would call it a reading, but a presentation of headlines and hopefully some humor and all of that. That's basically what we do. Tonight we're going to break in format. We are going to have for the full hour, as Larry King used to say, a program with a guest we've had a number of times in other series, Larry Hancock. Larry is an author. And he has written a book recently, but he's written a number of books, and we're going to talk about a number of those and several other things. And I am thinking here that we either have a call or we have Larry on the line. I'm not sure which. Let me see if I can open this up. Okay, are you there? No, let's try it this way. Oh, no, that wasn't it. These high-tech matters always bollocks
yes,
me.
Yes, it's Larry.
There he is. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm terrific. Very, very, very well. Larry has, as I mentioned, been on the show a number of times, or our shows at various locations a number of times, and we end up finding that our time is up before we realize we just barely started talking. So let me ask you a silly, unrelated question about anything, but let's do that. What was your high temperature in Oklahoma today?
High temperature was 55 today.
Well, that's not too terrible.
No, it's not too terrible. We do have an Arctic front coming through over Christmas, though, and in about a week from now or over Christmas time, we'll be down in the low 40s, high 30s.
That's your highs?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Well, as you know, we're in Arizona, and the high temperature today was in the 70s. I don't want to make you feel bad, but in the Phoenix metro area, it was in the high, not the high, I think the mid-70s.
Now, I have friends who live in L.A. that talk to me all winter long and make me feel bad.
Yeah, well, I used to live in L.A., but now I make you feel bad from Arizona. We obviously have a lot of listeners who are listening to this series who have not heard us together previously, so we're going to cover some ground that you and I have covered before, but that some people haven't heard, although anyone who is listening because they know you are probably very well aware of your books. But before we get into the books, let me ask you a stupid question I don't think I've ever asked you. What made you decide to start writing the books that have to do with research on historical and sometimes cataclysmic events? What got you started?
I was a history major in college. I've always loved history. I've been particularly interested in military/political history. And so I always enjoyed that sort of thing. My career took me in totally different directions, but after I retired, I got back into research in Cold War history, I guess you would say, the Cold War era. And after having done research and presentations and articles for, probably 8 or 9 years, I decided I would go ahead and take the plunge and start. Basically, I'd researched enough, so I decided that if I didn't do a book, I'd never remember what I'd researched. So I was like, okay, I need to start writing books so I can look this stuff up again.
Right. I see. You at least had to take a lot of notes so that you wouldn't forget about it. And also, as the process went on, obviously, lo and behold, you had a book.
Yeah, and then there was another book and another book, and I think I have two scheduled to come out next year, and with that it will be a total of 10, and I'm thinking of retiring from retirement.
Yeah, you're going to have to get a job so you can rest a little bit.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about what the first book was. What was your first book? I assume it's Someone Would Have Talked.
The first book was Someone Would Have Talked. It was on the Kennedy assassination, and was really the culmination. That the first book essentially was more or less, as I was talking about, to put the pretty extensive research I had done into print and make it available to other researchers. And that did fairly well, and there was enough response to it that I came back a few years later and did a larger sequel, but a second edition in 2010. And that led me into researching other political assassinations and on into other things. But for the first, I guess, better part of 15 years, I really was researching and writing about the Kennedy assassination, the RFK assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, political assassinations in general.
Right.
And then shifted on
States.
To other subjects.
You're talking about American political assassination.
Yes.
Yeah.
You've got to draw the line somewhere.
And it's a pretty wide border, a series of borders around which you can draw a line. I don't remember you writing a book about the RFK assassination. Did you do that book separately?
What I did in that one, and that's the only one I've done this way, I essentially wrote a book-length series of articles that were they're written by chapter, and for various reasons I wasn't satisfied. I didn't think I could get far enough towards a solution. I could very well describe a conspiracy in regard to the act, but I couldn't take it to where I wanted to take it. So I ended up publishing that online on the Mary Farrell Foundation website. So it's available online with illustrations and everything else, but it's the one that did not go into print.
And you said the Mary Farrell website. Why don't you give that that URL, that website?
Sure. It's Mary Farrell Foundation. So it is
Mary is obvious, but how's Farrell?
F-E-R-R-E-L-L.
Okay, foundation.
And so it really comes up well on a search. The easiest, if someone searches on Mary Farrell Foundation, that's the first thing they're going to find. And my article on the RFK assassination, the website's divided into segments, JFK, RFK, MLK,
mm-hmm.
Watergate, and it would be all you have to do is go to the RFK section and you'll
see
find it there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your response to the – well, before we get to the response, I was going to ask you the question about your response to the release of the JFK documents and the non-release of JFK documents, but I wanted to ask you first, tell our audience, if you would, first off, your website and then the convention. So let me ask you first, what is your website where people can see what you're doing?
Sure. My website is larry-hancock.com. It's Larry Hancock,
mm-hmm.
But there's a dash in the middle. So larry-hancock.com. And I do also have a blog on WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just search for Larry Hancock at WordPress or get there through the website.
You're easily findable.
Active. Yeah.
Yes. And so, and you blog regularly on the activities you're involved in terms of writing and activities related to the subjects you've covered and you're interested in.
I do. And I blog a lot these days on issues of national security. I kind of moved
mm-hmm.
on from the assassinations into broader national security issues. So, yeah, I do try to blog once or twice a week.
It must be nice to be retired.
it's lovely. Although I will say the manuscript that I just submitted to a publisher last week was
mm-hmm.
about 74,000 words. And I will say that for the last 5 or 6 months, that sort of restricted my blogging. That was a lot of work.
That would seem to kind of restrict how often you could put on shoes. That's a lot of writing.
And eat and a lot of other things. Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Yeah, I was saying, that's also the reason you're so thin, right? Because you don't get a chance to eat.
Oh, yeah. I guess I better write some more, after all.
Well, certainly after the holidays, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Todd, there are a lot of people who are interested in the Kennedy assassination, or I should say Kennedy assassinations, and Dr. King and the rest. But in terms of the JFK assassination and the surrounding information, you're still doing you're still involved with, I should say, because I don't believe you're in charge of it. You're still doing an annual convention or gathering, if you will, of researchers. And it usually takes place in Dallas, as I recall. Is that correct?
It does. It takes place in Dallas in the fall around the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. And I'm speaker chair, which means I locate and recruit and help select speakers for the event. And I've been doing that for at least a dozen years or so now. And, we had a conference last fall. It was quite good and still well attended. And there will be another one next year. And next year, of course, will be the 55th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. It's amazing that there's still that much interest, although I have to say, frankly, it's striking that there's still that much interest in JFK and in the Kennedy administration, as it were. It's like if anybody harkens back to history, it's back to JFK.
That's
like a seminal point in history.
Well, it was, obviously. Are you there?
Oh yeah, I think it is. This year I went to we tend to go to the Oklahoma State Fair. I went to the Oklahoma State Fair this year and started walking around the fairgrounds, and I noticed one of the large, very large display buildings at the fairgrounds was totally devoted to an exhibit on the Kennedy administration. And I'm going, this is 54 years after the fact, and the last couple of generations, why would they even know what it was about? But it was full.
And by the way, of course, this is the 100th anniversary of Jack Kennedy's birth. That may be why they had the display.
But again, the folks there, they assume, and this was a traveling exhibit, obviously they feel that there was a market for it. It was a fee-based exhibit. So it just has a lot of reach.
Well, I would assume that if one were to go, I mean, even today, but certainly, let's say, in 1900, okay, or 1920, which would have been about 55, if I'm doing my math right, about 55 years after the Lincoln assassination, you would still have that level of interest as well. Both of those things, I mean, we don't talk very much about James Garfield's assassination or William McKinley's, although William McKinley's assassination was certainly a pivotal moment because Teddy Roosevelt came into office as a result. But the fact is that both of those, the Kennedy and the Lincoln assassinations, really were major points in time or things that occurred in time that really have had a major impact on our lives, even Lincoln's to this day. The fact that you had Andrew Johnson come in, who was not as merciful as Lincoln was, I mean, that, that made a big difference.
Yeah.
And, of course, Kennedy
the transitions
Johnson,
were seminal, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead,
so,
please.
I find two things. There's still a huge amount of interest in the assassination itself, in the event, in the whatever. There is also a lot of interest just in Camelot, on the Kennedy, on Jack and Jackie and on the administration and the era that it was. And so it's actually not just the assassination. That certainly tagged it in time. But there seems to be a real affection for Camelot.
Well, I'll tell you my opinion, and we both know what that's worth. I'll tell you my opinion as to why that is. First off, he came into office, and I was a child when he came into office, and I believe you were too. I think we figured out once that we're around the same age. But I was, January of 61, so I was 9 years old. okay, not quite 10, when he came into office. And there was really a spirit of hope. You know, he talked in his inauguration speech about a new generation, you know, blah, 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 blah. And that really was reflective of what people felt. And then, and that remained all through that period, even though there were a lot of problems and issues, not least of which is Bay of Pigs, which also was related, as you have mentioned and as I've talked about, to Watergate. But the fact is that when the assassination took place, it felt like people felt, to a large extent, like they were being cheated.
Yeah,
okay?
Absolutely.
Was snagged away from them, you know. And so I think that has a lot to do with the reverence or adulation almost of the entire administration period. And unlike you, where you've done all this research in terms of the assassination, again, you know, I share your interest in U.S. history, but I've read a load of stuff about Kennedy, the two brothers, to some degree the assassination, but also just, you know, I've read Schlesinger's books, and I've read, you know, Sorensen, and oddly, a teacher I had at UCLA, who at the time was considered a Roosevelt scholar, I think he's still living, wrote a book on Jack Kennedy. His name is Bob Dalek. I don't know if you know the name.
Oh, yes.
But,
yes.
Yeah. He was a teacher of mine my first quarter at UCLA. And anyway, but he, you know, but every, I mean, lots and lots of people outside the assassination book industry, there are just a lot of books on that. And the obvious reason is what you were reflecting before, which is they sell. The interest is there.
And the other thing I think that really enters into it, and interestingly, that's kind of a transition into the documents, because
mm-hmm.
we have seen one of the things that the assassination gave us, the various inquiries gave us, the JFK Records Release Act gave us,
mm-hmm.
has been a tremendous level of detailed insight into the Kennedy administration. We have nothing
mm-hmm.
equivalent of the other recent presidential administrations. I mean, the documents that were released are documents that historians won't see for another 100 years. So we know a lot more about Kennedy and Vietnam and Kennedy in Cuba and Kennedy in Africa and Kennedy in Indonesia. There's
mm-hmm.
just, there's more to write about, but it's
sure.
also, we understand, and we don't just... not just a matter of speculation, now we can see the National Security Council discussions and the classified presidential directives and working memos. So it's a level of real history that we hardly have anyplace else.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you about Roosevelt in a moment, but before we do that, I want to know what you were saying about the historians would need 100 years to go through all this stuff. Is that what you're saying?
Right. I'll give you an example. Not 100 years
Please.
To go through. I'll give you an example. We know a great deal about the State Department under Kennedy, the Joint
right.
Chiefs under Kennedy, as I said, the minutes of the National Security Council meetings. If I wanted to know the equivalent information about Henry Kissinger in his various
okay.
roles under various presidents, I'm not going to find that because that's withheld. Now, nominally
gotcha.
Speaking, it will be released after a certain period of time, but I can't see that now.
Yeah, no, I understand. I misunderstood what you were saying. I thought you were saying that it would take a century for historians to go through the stuff that's been released or is going to be released.
It feels like it's already been that long.
yeah, well, there you go. And the thing about records and information, there is a lot, partly because of how long he was president. There's also, you know, there's a lot of stuff in terms of what went on in the Franklin Roosevelt administration. The one is inclined to say administrations, but administration, occurred for 12 years, rather, for four elections. But but there's a lot of stuff. Did you ever get a chance to read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, No Ordinary Time?
I read that a long time ago, not recently.
Right, Oh, no, I understand. And me too. But it goes into rather impressive detail, as you'll probably remember. It went into very impressive detail with regard to, you know, the stuff that was going on, at least with regard to the, you know, the Depression and the war, which obviously took up a large part of his time in office, and with Eleanor and all the rest. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there. So, and although that does relate to some degree to what you were saying, it's not quite 100 years, but it's a long time since 1945.
Yeah, and that's kind of what, that sort of stuff does emerge after a few decades. All I would say is that a lot of it's emerged much more quickly on Kennedy, because we've seen pretty in-depth books coming in for the last 25 years, you know, which is just ahead of the curve, basically.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. The thing you were talking about in terms of the record release, which is what you were talking about in terms of what we have access to now, do you have either a feeling or a perception of why it is that I understand it was an intelligence agency choice, but specifically why it was that certain records were not released?
Yeah, I think it's boiling down to, from what we have seen released, the records that were withheld were primarily withheld because they mentioned real names, true names of people.
Mm-hmm.
They mentioned true names of CIA contacts and assets and people the CIA was paying. I was just looking at some of those today. They mentioned basically operational information, that sort of thing, and that was supposed to be classified. So you really can't see why that was withheld. I think the strange thing is that in most instances, it's one document, and there were another 8 documents dealing with the same thing that we've already seen. And in most cases, we figured out who they were talking about already. So it's not that big a surprise.
Right. So it's like it was, you know, as you know, there is an, and probably most of our listeners are aware, there always has been an inclination on the part of government authorities to overclassify things. That is, to classify things that don't need to be classified. They're not telling anything new. You know, if they had a choice and if they still publish phone books, they'd classify the Manhattan phone book. You know, that kind of
absolutely
thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's what we're seeing, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, and so that's certainly part of it. And as you say, there may be some operational things that even all these years later, they still don't want to release information that will perhaps have an effect. I mean, in other words, I guess what I'm saying, which is also what you were saying, is some of the continued classification of documents relating to the JFK assassination are legitimate, but a lot of it isn't.
Some of it is legitimate. Some of it was just, as you say, some of it was just kind of silly and overcompensating, but I think everybody needs to realize that what really has happened at this point is they released thousands of pages of documents, but they're heavily redacted. I was just looking at a 100-page document, and 11 pages is available. The rest is still redacted.
Wow.
So everything that people thought the president said about really releasing all of this stuff, and, you know, there's a game still being played. The agency is not releasing what it – basically, down to this point, it's not releasing things that it doesn't want talked about in regard to the agency itself. And by the way, the CIA is the one that is playing those games on record releases. The FBI really has been quite good about releasing virtually everything and largely unredacted. So it's the CIA who's still in the record control business.
Yeah. So what goes on at your annual convention? I know it's not a secret. What goes on there?
It really is a research convention. Basically, we invite people who have done research, either document research. It's every year it's usually a composite of people who are deeply into the documents. These are people that have been able to identify crypts and true names, and so that we're now able to read a document and understand it. And they're so deeply into the documents that we now understand the transmittal systems, who's copied, what the initials say. So we can really read the history. But there aren't that many people that can do that. So we invite those folks, and they talk about what they're finding. Then there are the medical professionals. For example, we had a couple of fellows this year who have been able to go into the National Archives and in one instance actually look at directly at the X-rays of the president's autopsy. And so we have three or four professionals of that sort every year who are doing actually brand new research, some pretty fascinating stuff, because I want to have to say that, you know, these are people that are going in without necessarily any preconceptions, looking at information not under the parameters that the original autopsy was conducted. Let's put it that way.
For sure.
And they're finding a couple of things. But one of the things that's obviously emerged over since the work of the assassinations records group back in the 90s, it's been determined that a great deal of that medical evidence is either missing or incorrect. The people that originally did it don't recognize what's in evidence now. The autopsy doctors, when the autopsy doctors were called in the late 90s to review the photographs and X-rays and simply identify the entry and exit points in the body, they could not do it, which in any legal autopsy would be stunning. And it's when you look at the record of the transcript, essentially the autopsy doctor just kind of chuckles and goes, well, I hope you guys can figure it out. It's truly amazing.
Well, let's back up a little bit because of a couple of things you said. I want to go through them with you. You said the Assassination Records Group. Are you referring to the congressional investigation that took place? I think that was earlier, wasn't it?
ARRB, the Assassination Records Review Board, that was created in the 90s as a result of the JFK Records Act in the early 90s. And their charter was largely to get documents released, to collect documents, to look for documents that hadn't been taken into evidence. But along with that, they were looking at the body of evidence, and that's one of the things that led them to interview the medical doctors to try to determine what the issues with the evidence in hand are. And they discovered, for example, that there were three autopsy reports written and the first two disappeared. Some truly shocking stuff, but which is disconcerting to us because that story totally escapes the mainstream national media. Yet when we just had this Records Released Act, you had mainstream stories on trivial stuff that we've known for decades. And just because of all the furor over the records release, it got covered. None of it particularly significant, which is pretty frustrating.
Well, let's talk about this. By the way, let me mention a couple of things here really quickly. First off, let me remind our listeners, I almost said viewers, which mainly means people looking at their computer screen. Anyway, the website for Larry is Larry-Hancock, spellings are obvious, I assume. And the other thing is the books, not just Someone Would Have Talked, but all the others are available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all of the usual outlets. And I've read some of Larry's writing, and I can tell you it's well worth it. But that's one of the things I wanted to mention. Also, I'm going to do a quick commercial here, so stand by 1 second. If you're listening to the program, especially if you've listened to past programs, and you like what we're doing, you can help support the show. You can go to Patreon, patreon.com/Jeff Bushman. Again, that's patreon.com/Jeff Bushman. And thank you. Okay, that was my commercial. How'd I do?
Well done. Very succinct.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, there's no sense going on for 60 seconds when you can say it in 15. And if someone didn't hear it and they want to listen to and they're listening to the recording, they can obviously go back, right? Okay. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about the Kennedy assassination. I'll tell you the question that people always ask me on the rare occasions for me, and I'm sure the common and frequent occasions for you, that we talk about the Kennedy assassination, the big question, what's the number one question people ask you when they know that you are a quote-unquote expert or an author about the Kennedy assassination? What's the number one question? I'll tell you the one I get most in a minute.
The one I get most often actually goes back to the book title Someone Would Have Talked, and it's basically, if there was a conspiracy, nobody can keep that quiet, somebody must have talked, so why didn't they? And since they didn't, there must not be one. I mean, that's the logic.
Yeah,
the book is, that's it. And the book really takes that head on and says, well, yes, they did. You just didn't hear them.
Right. Well, the question I get most often, again, I don't discuss it as frequently as you do for obvious reasons, but the question I get is, okay, then who did it?
Well, that's pretty good because you immediately got the past the point that, yes, it wasn't just Lee Oswald, right? So it was a they. Who are they? Who did it?
Well, actually, the real question is a challenge. It's more like when they say it to me, it's more like, okay, smartass.
Who did it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other one is, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich? But leaving that aside, the question is usually, okay, if Oswald wasn't the lone assassin, who did it?
Yeah. And obviously, there are no finite answers to that. Obviously, I do have an opinion after dealing with this for over two decades, and I do wrap that up in the books. But I think one thing that's become pretty clear is that both let's put it this way. If you look at the events immediately following the assassination, over that weekend, over the next 48, 72 hours, one of the things that you definitely find is that the level of the president, the National Security Council, the chief of the Secret Service, there was a decision made not to pursue conspiracy.
Right.
And that was a national security level decision. All of those people were not complicit. I know there are people that think that because, you know, there are massive conspiracies that rule the world, but no. And they had to deal with the fact that there were lots of things that they had to do to obfuscate and manage evidence that you actually have a series of telephone calls from the White House back to multiple law enforcement people in Dallas that evening saying, under no circumstances are you to investigate, pursue, or charge anyone other than Lee Oswald.
Wow.
Okay. That's a matter of record. People have talked about receiving those calls. So that is not going to happen unless there is a real national security concern. And people are not going to comply with that order unless it's pretty clear there's something heavy involved. So that means the suspects have to be scary. I mean, that takes you in two directions. It's either the fact that they truly did suspect that Lee Oswald was working for Fidel Castro and that this was Oswald and others sponsored by Castro did the assassination, or they suspected that someone within the government itself, very probably someone within the CIA, had been involved. And in neither case would you want to go there. I mean, I might want to go there, but if you're so who did it quickly boils down to one of two sets. You know, one or two suspects. Was it Castro, or was it some group that was driven by, manipulated by, whatever, within the intelligence community? And after investigating both leads, I've come down, and in my book, Nexus, make a reasonable case that it originated within the intelligence community. The primary drivers behind it, the people who incited it, who drove it, were James Angleton, William Harvey, David Morales, senior CIA officers, and that they did it because they had learned that President Kennedy was entering into very serious back-channel conversations with Fidel Castro that very well might have gotten the Russians kicked out of Cuba and Cuba going neutral. And they just weren't prepared to tolerate that.
Right, and thus seeming to end a serious threat from the communists, and therefore not having the, what's the word I'm looking for, the fire behind the Cold War.
And if he had been able to do that, he would have had the leverage to get out of Vietnam gracefully.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you know, there have been reports recently that Lyndon Johnson said to some people that he thought that the Cubans were behind it because the Kennedy administration had gone through all of the nonsensical attempts to assassinate Castro and that this was payback. Then there was also a report recently, a long time ago, that said something about the Madam Nu and the other Vietnamese after the for those who are not familiar with this history, let me briefly explain. I'll diverge and give some history. When we fought the war in Vietnam, we went through a series of governments of South Vietnam, which was a side that was supposedly anti-communist that we were supporting. And one of the governments was run by a man whose name was Diem, D-I-E-M, and his sister-in-law, his brother's wife, Madam Nu, was in this country when a coup occurred in South Vietnam, and that government was taken over by the military. At the same time, Madam Nu believed, it's fairly clear that when the Vietnamese military said they wanted to go ahead and perform this coup, to engage in this coup, that they also wanted to kill Diem as part of that coup, and the word went out from the Kennedy administration, we would prefer you not kill him. Go ahead with the coup. We'd prefer you not kill him, but if you have to, we're not going to make a fuss about it. And that Madam Nu, when she was in this country, didn't necessarily know that, but she conceived that the coup in Vietnam, South Vietnam, could not have occurred without Kennedy's approval. So she spoke very harshly about Kennedy, both before and after his own assassination. That about covers that, just to bring people up. And Johnson thought it was Castro because of the garbage attempts to kill him.
Yeah, Johnson was very consistent in that. I mean, early on, when he brought Earl Warren in, he told Earl Warren that he had to essentially hold the commission and demonstrate Lee Oswald was the guy. And if he didn't, it would lead to a war. I mean, Johnson was very consistent. Throughout, whenever he described it personally, it was always something that JFK had done that had brought it on himself. And it's a very interesting psychological play because it was a standard Johnson game, whether it's blaming it on the Castro assassinations or the Diem coup, whatever it was going to have to be, it really was Jack's fault, and it's too bad, but, you know, he shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, and it was also a way of sullying Robert Kennedy, whom he despised, because Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General and primary confidant of President Kennedy.
But it's kind of fascinating in a way because he said that so often that, I mean, if you step back a minute, you're going, this is the President of the United States, and he knows that there was an action against a former president and against our country, and he's decided not to do anything about it. I mean, if you step back a couple of steps, it's not about Jack, it's about Johnson being an absolute coward, if that were true.
Well, I'm not sure it's cowardice, to be honest with you, because what you have is, you know, here is a guy who did not want to have a war that could very easily go nuclear. I mean, I don't think he did the right thing. That's not the point. But in terms of his motivation, I don't think his motivation was, you know, inherently evil. I think he, and I don't think it was necessarily cowardly. I think he was afraid of a war because even if the United States would, and we probably would have certainly in those days, won a nuclear exchange, that would have been a hell of a war.
Well, I thought that at one point in time too, Jeff, and that's actually a reason why I did the book Surprise Attack, because I thought, well, is Johnson, was he really afraid? Was he afraid that the Russians were behind it? Was he really sincere about telling Warren this? One of the things I did was to, that book actually looks at surprise attacks from Pearl Harbor through Benghazi. And it was a study of command and control, of presidential response, and it was basically looking to see if Johnson, among other things, A, did Johnson behave differently than other presidents during crises? And, you know, was he really concerned? And the answer is, from 5 minutes after the fact onward, he never, ever thought that the Russians or the Cubans were involved. Nothing that he ever did suggest that he was frightened of that. His decision not to pursue a conspiracy really wasn't that it was going to take him there. That was merely an excuse. But I was giving the same caveats that you are. And if we'd had this conversation 4 or 5 years ago, I would have probably just nodded and said, yeah.
Well, believe it or not, we've only got about 18 minutes left, according to the clock on my screen. So let me just ask you to briefly, I'd like to, of course, continue this conversation on another occasion, but let's talk about each of your books and a brief summary of what they're about, because I want to have people who are interested in your books who are not familiar with you know about that. We've already spoken, obviously, about Someone Would Have Talked, which is essentially all the research into the JFK assassination. And what was the book after that?
Well, Sharon, let me try to make some sense out of the sequence. The book after that was entitled Nexus. And Nexus is basically a study of CIA assassinations, because if my premise in Someone Would Have Talked, which is a large book with a lot of background and context, it's like, let's cut to the chase here and look at this and see how the CIA did do executive actions and who did them, and if so, how would you map this to the JFK assassination, and if they had done it, who would it be? And that was that book, which is a much shorter, more focused book.
But basically talks about how similar the assassination was and the reporting of it and the crossfire and all the rest of it, how similar that was to CIA directed assassinations in other countries, and how similar the JFK assassination was to that in large part.
And even going before, who had the ability to order those things, how they were, what was the trade craft, how did it really work? If you wanted to steal the process, you can only steal the process if you're inside the process.
Right.
So it was like, who would have been able to steal it? Who would have been able to essentially make it happen if it wasn't sanctioned? And that's what Nexus does.
Okay.
After that, I did do the work on the RFK assassination and wrote the paper that we talked about. Then I went on, and a friend of mine, Stu Wexler, and I got really involved in a restudy of the King assassination.
Right.
And the first book we did was called The Awful Grace of God, which is a study of the King assassination. And that book has a lot of original field investigation work in it. We took a lot of leads from the FBI that they dropped once they had James Earl Ray in prosecution, and we went forward with them to reveal what we thought was the rest of the conspiracy. And actually, we have a sequel to that book coming out next spring called Killing King, which contains about 4 more years of field research. Then after
Before you on, what more do we really? Probably we should discuss this on another occasion. But what more do we know about who did the the assassination setup, because obviously, what's his name? You mentioned it, and I've already forgotten.
Yeah.
James Earl Ray.
We really know.
I always want to say James Earl Jones, which is a terrible slur on a great actor. But go ahead with what you were saying. I'm sorry.
We know who had been trying to kill Ray kill King for some time, and who turned to a bounty offer. How they brought Ray into it, how they set him up, basically the process of a group of people who had been trying to kill King themselves and were forced, because they came under Tit's FBI pressure, to turn to outside folks and essentially did a contract. And that's where you end up with James Earl Ray.
And that relates to some of the claims that Ray was making. That there was that guy, if I recall correctly, his name was supposedly named Raul,
It relates to its claims about there having a conspiracy, which he actually said at his trial. We've been able to put that. That's probably the most innovative field research I've been involved with. Actually, getting down and digging out leads and finding people that hadn't been interviewed and so on and so forth. Following that, I got interested, as I said earlier, in some broader topics of national security, and I did the book Surprise Attack, which I described earlier. And along with Surprise Attack, in about the same period of time, I did a book called Shadow Warfare, which is a broader, lengthier study of covert action. In other words, how the CIA conducted covert action and shadow warfare, paramilitary actions during the Cold War.
Fascinating writing, and that's also where you wrote about the almost accidental nuclear wars, right? That was in Shadow Warfare.
Yes. And so those things brought me, it's kind of interesting, Shadow Warfare ends with how we converted from the CIA running these operations into a post 9/11 2001 scenario where the military runs the operations and the CIA supports them, and absolutely nobody in this country realizes that we now have units operating in 129 different countries.
Amazing.
Doing shadow warfare, and it's amazing that nobody knows that's going on. We are in full-scale war, and it's totally, okay.
As a side note, that happened recently when we had those guys killed. I'm trying to remember, was it Niger? People start to say, what are we doing in Niger? And they don't realize that we're all over the place.
And without
Which
most,
is what you were
many
saying.
Of them realizing that the National Guard units in their states are partnering with different African countries. And, of course, here in Oklahoma, our National Guard just got back from the Ukraine. A sequel to Shadow Warfare, if you think about it, if you flip the coin, if it's not shadow, it's political warfare. And so the book that I have coming out next fall is going to be called Creating Chaos, and is a study of both American and Russian political warfare through the Cold War into the 21st century, and up until last week.
Because at some point in time you had to close the book for the publisher.
Absolutely. It's kind of and it was a real sprint towards the end. It's like, I do not want to read more in the headlines this morning because I'm going to have to write about that. Could you people just stop?
Yeah. Stop doing anything.
But I personally consider it the best work I've done to date, with the most contemporary implications for a lot of things. And I am excited about it because everybody sort of looks at this thing piecemeal without looking at the big picture. And this book is kind of the big picture approach to what did the U.S. do, and then the U.S. changed its role, and Russia picked up the role the U.S. had, and it's really something called mirroring, and it's very scary because now they're doing what we used to do.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, it's scary regardless, but it's probably scarier in the hands of Putin than it is in the hands of our government up until the
it
last
is,
election.
It is, and actually, absolutely. And it's frightening to the extent it's the same things, and they're actually doing a better job than we were because they have technology that we didn't have, but it's there's nothing new to it. It's sort of you can tell exactly what's going to happen next because you look at what we did.
Right. And
it
you
probably
also
won't turn out well for them in the long run, but short term, it's a pain. And I did one book that was a tangent off all this because I've been interested in this a long time, and it has obviously intelligence and national security connotations. I did a book on UFOs. That was published last year called Unidentified, the National Security Problem of UFOs. And it's a very historical, factual study and analyzing basically military encounters with UFOs. And I think that takes me up to 10 books, and now I'm really tired again.
Just talking and thinking about it. I've got to tell you something that you may find amusing. I find amusing. Okay. First off, let me say, in terms of the audience, I really enjoy virtually all of the guests that we've ever had on the show. And I, you know, like talking to different people and everything. But Larry is probably my favorite. Okay. Don't get a swelled head, okay? But
I'll try.
But my least favorite guest, I can say this because I'm reasonably sure that he won't be listening. I had done some searching for people to interview. And came across this fella, a nice man, who had authored a science fiction book, right? So he offered to send me the book. So I said, sure, I'd love to see it. You're not going to be on for a couple of weeks, so I'll get a chance to read it. Well, at Stately Bushman Manor, we received his book. It was 5 volumes, big volumes. And of course, I didn't read it. I read a few pages of one of them. First off, I'm not really that into science fiction, but I read a few pages of one of the books, and frankly, it was not my cup of tea. And my wife, who isn't into science fiction, took a look at it and she said, "This is not very good." Okay, but then the gentleman was on the show, and he started talking, and I was told later by someone who I knew who had been listening to the show that my response brought gales of laughter in the group he was sitting with. But the guy said, I said, how did you really, I asked him how he got interested in UFOs, and he said, well, I was abducted. And I said, ah. What are you going to say, you know? I'm assuming that's not your situation.
No, that's pretty, in fact, I'm not going to say it, but I'm pretty safe bet I know who you're talking about. But no, this is definitely not my situation.
Well,
situation
I just realized
is the
I was
opposite.
Taking a chance. I just realized I was taking a chance. Boy. Anyway, your situation is the opposite in what respect?
Well, my approach to it is again, what I actually do in the book. About the first half of the book is a historical study of basically the intelligence channels. How has the military handled this? Who was involved in it from World War II forward? How did the intelligence community respond to it? What did the Air Force do? What did the CIA do? To basically tell you how it was really treated, and it was treated very seriously. And there is there's absolutely no doubt, as it should have been, because it was viewed as a potential threat. So I do that, give the history of that context, and then I use a technique which is called pattern analysis, indication analysis, and I look at some 1,500 unknown events that ended up unknown in the Air Force Blue Book files and do an indications analysis to assess perhaps what was going on. Is there something real there? What patterns does it show? How does it evolve over time? In other words, what's going on? And it's something the Air Force never did, something the CIA never did, because historically there was a point in time in 1952 where the CIA recommended taking it to the National Security Council, prioritizing it, and really tasking it to the people that do this kind of study. Well, for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen, so this kind of study never got done. So I said, hey, somebody should do it.
Let's do it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you have any quick, brief conclusions you can share with the audience, or is it just a matter of it's much more comprehensive than that and you need to read the book?
Well, I think the conclusion is there is something, there is an unknown. There is an unknown factor, and whatever the unknown is, I'm not going to call it aliens, whatever. Whatever the unknown is, it's very clear what it was interested in. It was absolutely interested and focused on the United States atomic warfare complex, the development of atomic weapons, radioactivities, the evolution of those into megaton-class warheads, the movement of them out to bomber and missile sites. I mean, these, the real core of the reports are something that is absolutely focused on determining our abilities in atomic warfare and what our defensive capabilities are in regard to same.
Right. And they were interested in that presumably to either assess our defensive capabilities or to assess how dangerous we were, I assume. I mean,
absolutely.
I understand you may not know the answer to that, but that's the logic of it.
And the logic is one of the things that if you look at it to some extent, it is very similar to what we did with both the Russians and later the Chinese and the North Koreans in terms of assessment, even to the level of sending down what are pretty obviously drone-type probes to do particulate collections to assess the radioactive materials.
Wow. Yeah.
It gets very specific.
Interesting stuff. Well, sir, we have exhausted the hour. We've got about 3 minutes left of the program. I'd love to do this again soon. If you're available sometime in January, like the 5th or the 12th, we can do that if you're available.
You bet. Always happy to talk.
Okay, great. And we'll talk about the Kennedy assassination. I'd love to talk to you about King in greater detail.
Absolutely.
And shadow warfare. I mean, both of those are just like really fascinating subjects. You can stay with me for a second, but I'm going to go ahead and basically sign off here. Next week, for all of you who are listening, and I'm speaking to both of you, next week for all of you who are listening, we will be without a guest, but we will be discussing some things about the tax bill that the Republican Congress and some things that are wrong with it that you're not hearing about. Specifically, just as a quick couple of things, the risk of inflation and our further indebtedness to the Chinese government, all related to the tax bill. And we will discuss that next week. We may have a shorter show. And on the 29th, of December, we will be dark. We will not be broadcasting on that night because nobody will be around anyway. So next week we're on, and we'll discuss the tax bill implications that aren't being discussed, and then following that, one dark week, and then we'll be back January 5th. So thanks for listening. Join us next week. Larry, thank you again. And for those of you who tuned in late, you're going to be Mark Tardy, but make sure to go to larry-hancock.com to see Larry's books, or just look up Larry Hancock on Amazon, and you will find a fascinating trove of reading. Larry, thanks. We'll talk soon.
You bet.
All right, man. Take care. Bye-bye. And again, to those of you who are still with us, thank you for listening, and join us next week. And if you hate the show, let me know. And if you like the show, tell a friend. Anyway, thanks again. Don't go away mad. Somewhere, it's around midnight. Good night, everybody.